Well, good evening. Welcome to Next Level. My name is Rob Shepherd. I'm the lead pastor at Next Level, and I'm very excited to have you guys here tonight. Tonight, we're continuing our series entitled Risk, and I'm really excited about tonight because tonight's talk is actually the one that inspired this whole entire series. And so if this is your first time, I think this is a decent week to come. If you've been tracking along with us, I think you'll see where this fits in with where we've been and where we're going with this series. And I don't know about you, but I absolutely love stories. I love stories. I love to tell stories. I love to hear stories. And I don't know if it's because I grew up loving movies and I love great stories in movies, but I absolutely love stories. And one of my favorite things to do in this whole entire world is to gather with my family. It's often around Thanksgiving or Christmas, and just tell stories. And sometimes my brother and I go back and forth and we just start telling stories and we can go on for a long period of time. And we've all heard the stories before. We know the punchline. We know what happens, but we just always laugh and laugh and we just have a great time. And I didn't want to just tell you one of the stories that my brother and I tell. I wanted you to experience just a little taste of what it's like around the holidays with my family. And so I've asked my little brother, John Shepherd, to come up and to share some stories with me. Would you guys help me welcome my brother to the stage? Now, I know that for most of you, it's pretty obvious because we look just alike, so you knew if you've seen him around that that's my little brother. He's 4 years younger, and this has kind of been a dream of mine to always have him up here to share some part of the stage with me, and he's never done this before, and so I'm pretty excited about it. I don't know if you're nervous at all, but...
Not too much, but sympathy laughs will
help. All right, so you heard him. Give him some sympathy laughs. So this isn't really rehearsed. We didn't, like, write these stories down. We just want to tell stories like we do around the holiday times. I share the story of one of the first times that Mom and Dad put Sarah, we have an older sister, her name is Sarah, they put her in charge of us. She was the babysitter. She was supposed to be babysitting us. Tell us a little bit what happened then.
Well, they left for about 2 hours, and once the door closed, the dictatorship of Sarah began. She just started, you know, throwing rules at us and trying to make us do all kinds
bossing
of
us
stuff,
around.
Bossing us around, stuff that she never asked us to do or we'd do otherwise, but she was demanding we did it. And my parents had bought us some blow pops before they left. They handed them out and closed the door and thought that that would help us to, you know, be submissive to Sarah. But after a couple minutes of her just kind of going at us, I took my freshly bought blow pop and chomped into it, exposing the extra gooey, chewy bubble gum that is inside all blow pops. And I just had enough, you know, I said enough is enough, and I just chucked it across the living room.
And,
At Sarah. And at that time, Sarah had this mane. I mean, it was like Mufasa from Lion King.
Chewbacca.
Yeah, it was like Chewbacca. And it just went right in the middle of her hair. I mean, it couldn't have been better. It wasn't at the end. It wasn't at a place you could just snip off. It was dead
center.
Middle. And she went ballistic.
Lost it.
She ran off, ran to the bathroom.
Screaming.
And frantically tried to get it out of her hair. And that was the best 2 hours we had that day.
That's right.
When she left us alone and we were able to
hang
out by
ourselves. The
rest of the
time we just went into one of the bedrooms and we just played and hung out. And here's just a note to you new parents. If you're going to bribe your kids, bribe them with the prize after they do what you want them to do and not before, because it obviously didn't work for us. One of the things that happened in a lot of our stories is I do something and John ends up getting hurt. And it was never at least intentional in my mind, but there are lots of stories where I'm playing the part of the older brother, he's playing the part of the younger brother, and one of our favorite stories is when I was in high school, he was in middle school, he was 4 years younger than me, and I had the job of driving him to school every week. And so I had to drive him to school every day and then drive him back home. And our vehicle of choice was a blue minivan. We were rocking the blue minivan to school. And one day, my brother is coming out from school, and you got to understand, I don't know why you did this, but when he was in middle school, he used to put every book in his locker in his book bag. Every book.
It was the whole locker in my book bag.
The whole locker. And everything in the locker.
And I wasn't doing the homework, so I don't know
yeah,
why
I, don't know where,
I had all the books.
I don't know where you're bringing that to. But he would walk out of school, and he had this book bag on his back, and literally he would have to walk out like this, because it was like when he was a skinny little, not tall, middle schooler. And so he walks out to the car, and I don't know why on this day I decided to pull a little prank on him. But when I was in middle school, my older high school friends, they used to do this thing with the car. Maybe you've seen this done. But like when the passenger goes to open up the car, the driver hits the gas. And so you miss the car handle. And so I decided to do this. And I did it about 3 or 4 times. And he missed every time. And here's something you need to know about me. I don't have an off switch sometimes. And so when something starts to happen, I start to take it to like the furthest degree. And after about the fourth or fifth time, John actually gets the door open. And I think I'm going to press my luck and hit the gas and do this one more time. And he does something that I did not see coming. Tell us what you did.
Like a scene out of Spider-Man, I grabbed the strength to jump, leap, and grab onto this van. Well, Rob's still in the stop-and-go mode, so he floors the gas, and I'm still hanging on. With the 175-pound backpack that's strapped to my 85-pound self.
So he goes, literally, this is not exaggerated. I see out the side of our van window, I see 2 feet just flying, and my brother is parallel with the van car, and he lands, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I just killed my brother. Like, I totally freaked. I got scared. I stopped the car. I ran around the van, and I said, are you okay? And he just has this shocked look on his face. Praise God from whom all blessings flow that he was wearing that book bag, because the book bag protected his fall. He didn't hit his head. He didn't have a scratch on him. His books weren't even damaged. Like, he just landed. He landed on the books. And so once I figured out that he was okay, I grabbed him by the book bag, and I threw him in the van, and we got out of there really quickly because I didn't want to get in trouble. My mom was a part of the administration of our school, and I was thinking, okay, he's not dead, so I'm not going to get in trouble. So we got in the van, and we left, and I felt really bad that this happened, and so I thought I would bribe him. And where did I tell you I was going
to
take you?
He said, I'll take you to Toys R Us and buy you a toy. You know, just don't tell mom or dad.
Right. So I take him to Toys R Us to buy him a toy of his choice. And when we pull up to Toys R Us, he gets out. And I don't know why it took him so long to notice this, but when he gets out to walk on the street to get to Toys R Us, he says to me, I don't have my shoe. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't have your shoe? He's like, I don't know. I don't know where my left shoe is. So he had to walk around Toys R Us
with no shoe,
yeah, on. And we walk around the whole thing. I buy him the toy. He gets back into the car, and I say, all right, we've got to go get your shoe because I don't want to get in trouble. So we go back to our school, and we look around the parking lot. His shoe's nowhere to be found. And so we get to our house, and I'm like thinking, like, great, like, now I'm going to have to explain what happened to this shoe, and I'm trying to figure out a way to tell my mom what happened without actually telling him that he flew out of the car. And, like, I'm trying to figure this out. And we open up the door, and my mom meets us in the hallway, and she says, funny thing happened at the end of the school day. One of the secretaries said she happened to look out the window when she saw John fly out the side of our van. And she ran out there to see if he was okay, but by the time she got out there, you guys were gone. And the only thing sitting in the parking lot was this shoe. Can you tell me what happened?
Busted.
So I got busted, and you still got to keep the toy. Cause yep. I still
and
felt
I got
bad.
My shoe back. So
and,
it's a win-win
and you got your
for
shoe
me.
Back. Win-win for you. All right. Now, I've told you guys, if you read my blog, I've mentioned these stories before, and I've shared a couple in sermons before, but I'm notorious for doing really crazy things in my sleep. I don't mean to do this, but I'm just like a psycho in my sleep. And when I was in probably early high school, I asked you to do something for me. What did I ask you to do when I was... Yeah.
Rob loved the show Mickey Mouse Club.
Don't judge me.
He was a big fan. And he told me, he said, John, whatever you do, don't let me miss Mickey Mouse Club at 4:30. So, you know, I was like, all right, whatever. So 4:30 came, and Rob had fallen asleep on the couch. He was out cold. I mean, he was in hibernation mode. And 4:30 came, and I went up to him. I said, Rob, Mickey Mouse Club's on. And I didn't even care for Mickey Mouse Club, so I was, you know, happy with him sleeping through it. But I kept persisting. I said, Rob, Mickey Mouse Club's on. And he wasn't moving. And so I kind of bowed him a little harder. I said, Rob, Mickey Mouse Club's on. And like waking a sleeping bear, he turned around like George Foreman and sucker punched me right dead in the chest. I mean, he whipped around and just hit me. I flew in the air, landed in the middle of the living room.
In the middle of the living room. So I wake up because I hear this, and I look over, and like he's laying on the floor. And the first thing that I notice is now it's like 4:31, and so I've missed the beginning of Mickey Mouse Club. And I'm like, why didn't you wake me up for Mickey Mouse Club? And he's like, I tried. And I said, like, what happened? He's like, you hit me. And I was like, what? I didn't even remember. I had no idea that I punched him. It was totally in my sleep. But those are the type of stories that we tell around holiday times. You guys help me thank my brother for going down memory lane with me. Now, I wanted you guys to experience that because that's just a small taste. My brother and I, we do that for long periods of time, especially at holiday times. And often we'll leave, and my wife Monica will say to me, I don't have any stories like you and your brother growing up. And here's the thing that I love to do. I love to take something that's happened to us and turn it into a story worth remembering. I love just seeing something, whether it's a bad thing or a funny thing or just something, and putting a twist on it to be able to tell a memorable story. At the beginning of last year, I read a book that impacted me and impacted my view of story. It's a book by Donald Miller called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years. And I don't know if you've read any of Donald Miller's stuff, but Donald Miller, in the book, he writes about how he was wrote a best-selling book, a New York Times best-selling book called Blue Like Jazz. And the book just sold like hotcakes. It made him a big name on the scene. And everybody was thinking this is the next great author to come out. But then he writes a book after that and another book after that. And I think he had a third book after Blue Like Jazz, and nobody read them. They didn't sell anything. They didn't even sell half of what Blue Like Jazz sold. So here Donald Miller is. He's starting to gain weight. He's getting depressed. He's lost his motivation for life, and he just can't write. He has a deadline to write a book, and he can't write it. He has nothing to write. He has no great stories to tell. And while he's sitting at his computer, he gets a phone call from two guys in Nashville, and they want to turn his book, Blue Like Jazz, into a movie. Now, Donald Miller doesn't understand how you can turn his memoir into a movie, but he decides to go along with the ride, and because he's never made a movie before, he decides to go to Hollywood to take this class on story. While he's in Hollywood, he hears the definition of what a story is, and I want to share with you the definition that Donald shares. He says, a story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. A story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. I think every great story that we've ever been told fits this definition. A story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. At my house right now, my kids are obsessed with Toy Story. Toy Story fits this perfectly if you've ever seen it. Who is the main character of Toy Story? It's Woody. And what does Woody want? What is the thing he wants to overcome? He wants Andy's attention. He wants to be Andy's favorite toy. But there's a conflict in the movie. What's the conflict? Buzz Lightyear to the rescue. And he has to overcome the conflict. He has to get over it to the end of the movie. Any movie that you like that is a great, memorable movie has this arc in it. You think about Star Wars. Any Star Wars fans here? 2.5 of you. Star Wars, if you look at the original Star Wars, it fits this perfectly. There's a character. Who's the main character? It's Luke Skywalker. What does he want? The Force. He has to overcome the conflict of people telling him that he can't have the Force, that the Force is dead. He has to overcome lots of conflicts to get where he wants to go. Every great story. You think about the greatest story ever told. What is it? It's Jesus. And what did Jesus do? Jesus wanted something. He looked down and he saw his creation. They were separated by sin. And he said, that's wrong. I've got to fix that. I've got to do something. So he comes down. That's the problem he wants to solve. He comes down to solve that problem. And then what's the conflict? Death. He dies. And if you didn't know the end of the story, you're like, this isn't supposed to happen. The main characters don't die. But Jesus dies. And 3 days later, he rises from the grave. He overcomes sin and death. We can become redeemed through him. And that fits this perfectly. A story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. The truth of the matter is I think that every story fits that definition, and I honestly think that every single person in here wants to live a good story. I don't think that anyone in here is sitting here and saying, you know what, one day, hopefully many, many years from now when I die, I want people to stand up at my funeral and say, yeah, you know what, they were pretty boring. I think we, inside of us all, we want to live a great story. We want to be one of those characters. We want to do something more than just like the ordinary. We have something inside of us that is driving us to do something great. But the problem is that most of us lose focus of what that great thing is because we get worn out by the mundane. I think that we so often get stuck in the mundane things of life that we forget to live. I want that to come up on the screen. I want you guys to see that with me. We so often get stuck in the mundane things of life that we forget to live. You see, I think the voice that is louder than your desire to live a great story is the voice that says you have bills to pay, you have a job to go to, you have a family to raise, you have laundry to do. We get so stuck on the mundane things of life that all of a sudden years go by. And if you look back and say, hey, what is the story I'm living? You're just like, man, it's kind of boring. There's nothing exciting about my story. But tonight, what I want to hopefully inspire you to do is I want you to know that God has wired you for more than the mundane. God has put inside of you a desire to live an amazing story. And how do we know that? Because you are a character in God's great story. God thought of you. The God of the universe, the God that is incredibly creative, the God that created things like the platypus, that's amazingly creative. He also thought of you, and he's placed you in this story. And you were created for so much more than just living. God has wired you to live a great story. And tonight what I want to do is I want to share one of the greatest and most famous Bible stories, and the goal is to inspire you out of the mundane. It's to inspire you to live a great story, because you are one of the greatest characters in this world. Now, the story that I'm going to share is a story that's probably pretty familiar to some of you. I think it's probably the second most famous story in the entire Bible. I think the first story is the story of Jesus. I think the second most famous story in probably the whole entire Bible is the story of David and Goliath. Now, this story, there's too much going on here for me to do the whole thing, so we're going to actually break this talk into 2 weeks. So this is a to be continued. You're going to hear part of it tonight. Hopefully you'll come back next week and you'll hear the conclusion. Because tonight what I want to do is I want to focus on the very first part of the definition of story, which a story is a character that wants something. And we're going to see in the story of David and Goliath that David was inspired to want something, and his inspiration led him to the start of an amazing story. Now, I need to give you a little bit of backstory in order for you to understand what's going on. In this story, there's a guy by the name of Samuel, and Samuel is the prophet of God. He's kind of leading Israel. If you were here last week, we talked a lot about Samuel, and Samuel was the guy that Israel came to and said, "Hey, we want a king." And Samuel responded back to them, "No, you shouldn't get a king. Like, you're rejecting God. God is your king." But they said, "We don't care. We want a king anyway." And so Samuel goes to God and says, "Hey, they want a king." And God says, "Okay, give them what they want. It's going to be their ruin, but you give them what they want anyway." So Samuel gives them a king, and the king's name is Saul. Now, Saul does everything that Samuel promised. He puts the people in slavery by taxing them and by creating armies and all this stuff. And so they're living as a nation. Now they have this king. But Saul continues to make one bad choice after another. In fact, it gets to the point where God actually takes his hand off of Saul. And he just says, "This is no longer my king." He's still going to be the king until he dies, but he's no longer going to lead the people as king. And God tells Samuel to go pick the new king. And he tells him to do this in secrecy so that Saul doesn't find out. And so Samuel goes to this dad by the name of Jesse. And he goes to find the new king. He knows that one of Jesse's sons is going to be the new king. But Jesse has 8 sons. And when Samuel walks up and sees the first son, he sees that he's tall. He still sees that he's strong. He thinks, "This is going to be the new king of Israel." He gets really, really excited. And that's where our story picks up. Look at what God says. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" This is so important for David's story, but it's also important for our story. You see, I think that so many of us aren't living a great story because of an insecurity that's inside of us. I think that there's so many of us here that are sitting here and we say right away, when you hear that God's wired you to live a great story, right away you start giving excuses. "Well, I'm not famous enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not good looking enough. Oh, if you knew my sin, if you knew my past, if you knew the things that I did, I'm not talented enough. I can't play an instrument. I can't preach. Surely you're not talking about me. Surely it's not me that's going to live a great story. Surely I can't do anything." And I just want to tell you, if you're here tonight and you have flaws, you are in the perfect place for God to use you. In fact, every story that we love, the great stories that we really love, aren't they stories of like the nobody that overcame great like tragedy? Think about some of the greatest stories in Hollywood. In fact, when Hollywood finds a story like this, they call it gold. They know it's going to make a lot of money. Stories like Rocky. If you've ever seen the first Rocky, what's it about? It's about a bum, a guy that is no good, and he gets picked to fight the champ, and he just wants to go 15 rounds. He doesn't even want to win. He just wants to go the distance, and he doesn't win. Sorry to ruin it for you. If you haven't seen it, it came out in 1979. You should catch up with the times. Rocky Balboa loses to Apollo Creed in the 15th round. But why is that story so amazing? Why did it spawn 5 sequels? Because it's about a nobody who overcomes great, like just awful circumstances to do something amazing. We love stories like that. How many of you have seen the movie Rudy? A couple of you. Rudy. Rudy's story should not have made a movie. Have you, like, think about Rudy. What is Rudy's story? It's a story about this, like, short, fat kid who likes Notre Dame and wants to play football for him. Now, if Hollywood was writing this story, if it wasn't based off reality, you know what would have happened? He would have got there and he would have made the team and he would have, like, scored a touchdown or done something big. But the whole movie, he can't make the team. And then he finally, like, gets there, and his senior season, they put him in for, like, 2 plays. That was it. Everything led up to 2 plays. But why do we love that? It's because of nobody, like, overcame great circumstances to do something. But it's not just Hollywood that loves these stories. God just is wired by these stories. You don't believe me? Try reading your Bible. You'll read things like Moses. God tells Moses to lead the children of Israel. And you know what Moses says? I can't do it, God. I'm a stutterer. God says, "You know what? Man looks at the outside. I look at the heart." You say, "Oh, that's just one example." No, there's tons of examples. Jesus, when he picks his team, to like just lead this movement that he started, you know who he picks? He picks tax collectors and fishermen, the lowest of the low. Nobody would have looked at these guys and said, "Yeah, you want to start a movement? Pick them." He picked the losers. He picked the nobodies. Paul's one of the greatest men of the New Testament. In fact, he wrote half of the New Testament of our Bible. Paul was responsible for murder. He was not the best of the best. In fact, there's stories of Paul not even being a great speaker. He was not the one that you looked at and said, yeah, that's going to lead a movement. And so if you're here today and you're saying to yourself, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I don't have enough money. If you saw my past, you wouldn't be saying this. You are in the perfect position for God to do something amazing in you. Here's the reason why God loves the people that just have faults and failures and aren't good enough. It's because we live the story and He gets the glory. You ever think about this? No one likes to celebrate the most pretty girl in school who wins homecoming queen. We don't get excited about that. Why? Because she's going to get it. She's the prettiest girl in school. We don't get excited about the guy who wins at every sport he plays and he never loses. That's not an exciting story to us. What is exciting? It's exciting when someone that like can't do something, that shouldn't do something, they overcome great obstacles to do something. And when you are a Christian and you work on your heart, when you work on your heart, you give your heart to God. You pour your heart out to God. You say, God, use me despite my faults, despite my failures. When you use me, then people look at you and say, you're living an amazing story, but then you don't get the glory. They say, you must have an amazing God because you're doing things that are way bigger than your pay grade. The first three people that I told about starting Next Level Church told me that I shouldn't do it. They told me that I didn't have the giftedness. They told me that I wasn't wired to do it. And a lot of people would get discouraged by that. It wasn't just one person. It was literally the first three people that I told. But I look back at that and I love that. I get excited about that. This is why I get excited, because when God does something in our little church, when God moves, you can't point back and say, yeah, it was a home run for God to use that pastor. You can say, man, I don't know how God's doing it. We've got a loser pastor. People didn't even think he should start a church, but God's doing something amazing. I'm going to live the story. God's going to get the glory. And it's the same thing with you. You think, oh, you don't have the giftedness, you don't have the talents, you don't have the right job, you haven't had the right family history. You're in the perfect position for God to use you. And you work on your heart. You give your heart to God. You sell it to God. You live your story, then He'll get the glory, and He'll use you in amazing ways. Now, that's not the sermon. That's like the introduction to the sermon. But you needed to get that in order to get what the sermon is about. The story goes on to David is now crowned as king, and Samuel had to go through eight brothers before God finally gave him the green light. He went through seven brothers, and God kept saying, that's not the one, that's not the one, that's not the one. And then he finds David, and David was a little shepherd boy. Now, many scholars believe that David was a teenager when this went down, but I don't understand why people think he was a teenager. Because everything that I've ever read says that in Israel's culture, when you became a man, you were at the age of 12. And so many guys by the age of 12 were getting married. And everything that references David says he was a little shepherd boy. So I'm thinking, at best, he's 12, but he probably was like 9, 10, 11 years old. Now, I'm not a scholar, so maybe I'm wrong, but most scholars believe he was at least like 15, 16. He's in his teens. This is not like a grown adult. This is not like the shoe-in. You first read this story, and you don't know the outcome, and you're like, surely that's not the king. And everyone thought that because he wasn't good enough. But God looked at his heart. From there, let's pick up the story and see what happens next. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale of armor, bronze weighing 5,000 shekels on his legs. He wore bronze greaves and bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Okay, this is what's going down. We're now introduced to the adversary. We're introduced to the struggle. His name is Goliath. And all that stuff sounded like a foreign language to me. So let me just tell you what this means. Goliath was a bad man. Goliath was bad to the bone. In fact, when you do like all the math and figure out all those calculations, Goliath was over 9 feet tall. Over 9 feet tall. The adversary that this little shepherd boy is going to face is over 9 feet tall. Now, you need to understand this. And some of you, maybe you're visual learners like me. And so I had to put this into perspective. I had to look at this. And I don't know if there's any basketball fans, but I think the most dominant big man in the history of the game, at least in the history of my lifetime, is a guy by the name of Shaquille O'Neal. He's 7 feet, 1 inch tall. He was bad to the bone. And we've got a picture of Shaq compared to Goliath, just for you visual people, just to see what this looks like. It's going to come up on the screen for you. There's Shaq, 7'1". There's Goliath, 9'6". Okay? You've got to paint this picture in your mind. And Goliath wasn't like a skinny guy. He wasn't, you know, you ever seen like someone tall, but they're like really skinny, and you're not afraid of him because you're like, I could just blow and you'd fall over? That wasn't Goliath. Like, he's carrying really heavy things. He's carrying like these huge weapons and these huge like breastplate. And he's like, he is a bad man. So we're introduced to Goliath, and this is what happens next. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, or are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now, if you've ever read through the Old Testament, you'll see that, one of the main enemies of God's chosen people, of the Israelites, was this group called the Philistines. They were to the Israelites as the Boston Red Sox are to the New York Yankees. They were to the Israelites as the Celtics are to the Lakers, as the Duke Blue Devils are to the Tar Heels. If you're a sports fan, you get the picture here. They were the enemy, and they fought all the time. I don't even know why they're always upset with each other, but they're always fighting. And in this battle, they line up to fight one another, but instead of fighting, this huge giant named Goliath comes out, and he says, "I defy the armies of Israel." And this is the challenge that he throws down. He throws down the challenge for them to send one man from Israel to come out and fight him. And he says, "If I beat your man, then all of Israel will become our slaves. But if your one man beats me, we'll become your slaves." Instead of rising up, instead of saying, "You know what? How dare you challenge God's army?" What did the people of Israel do? They became afraid. And the Bible says that Goliath made this challenge for 40 days. Goliath makes this challenge for 40 days where he comes out and he taunts them. Now I want you to hold on to that because it's going to play an important part in our story. Let's keep reading. "Now Jesse said to his son David, 'Take this ephah and roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines.'" So this is what happens. We're now reintroduced to David's dad. David's dad is Jesse. And Jesse is worried about his sons. Why is he worried about them? Did you catch it? It was at the end. He's worried because he thinks they're fighting. He doesn't know. They don't have MSNBC or Fox News or CNN, whatever your political affliction is. They don't know. They don't have that back then. They just know there's a battle going on. And he's worried about his sons because he thinks they're fighting. He doesn't know that they're not fighting. They're just staring at this other army and just listening to this guy named Goliath challenge them. And so he's worried about his kids, so he sends the youngest son, David, who's just a shepherd boy. He sends him with some food, and the food is just a ploy to get him in there. He says, "Here, take this food and go find out how your brothers are doing. Make sure your brothers are okay." So this is what happens next in the story. It says, "Early in the morning, David left the flock in the care of a shepherd, loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle position, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brother how they were. As he was talking with them, Goliath the Philistine, champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance. And David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they fled from him in great fear." This is where the story really gets good. For 40 days, Goliath stands out and he makes this challenge and nobody does anything. But then this little shepherd boy that nobody expects to do anything, he shows up with some food for his brothers. And he sees the armies lining up. And instead of getting the food, he leaves the food with the guy that just watches the stuff. And he goes to the battle lines, and he's like just looking, watching like what's going to happen here. He's waiting for this battle, and he's ready. He's like, okay, here the Philistines are there, the Israelites are here. It's going to go down. It's about to happen. They're about to fight each other. But instead of fighting, this giant comes out, and he says, "I defy the armies of Israel." And everyone in Israel gets afraid. For 40 days they hear this, and they're afraid. This is what happens, though. This is so amazing. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Now, we're not even getting to the battle yet. That's next week. We're not going to get to the famous fight. We're going to talk about it next week. But I just want you to reflect on this statement for a little bit. Here is David, and I wasn't there to hear how he said it, but I just imagine how he said it. I imagine this little shepherd boy that no one's paying attention to. He speaks up, and he's like, pardon me, hey guys, what do I get if I take out the giant? And before he can even process that thought, he gets kind of cocky. He's like just arrogant, and he's like, who is that giant that should defy the army of the living God? Can you imagine this? This is the stuff of a great story. You have a little boy. Everyone else is afraid. These grown men who have fought battles are afraid. But David stands up and he says, who is this punk that should defy the armies of the living God? There was a problem that David saw, and nobody was doing anything about it. Everyone else was afraid. Everyone else was scared. But David said, this is not right. And if you want to live a great story, it starts with that. It starts with seeing a problem where you say, this is wrong. I've got the living God inside of me. I am God's army. I am created in God's image. God has wired me to do something great. And there is a problem in our world, and it should not exist because we serve the living God. You need to find that problem. In fact, there are two questions that this is our application for the night. I would like for you to write them down because I think it's going to help you find your story. It's going to help you find the thing that's going to drive your life. The first question is, what is a problem that bothers you? What is a problem that bothers you? What was David's problem? David's problem was there was a giant who was defying the armies of the living God. Why was this a big deal? I'll tell you why it was a big deal. Because in their time, they felt like the army that won served the best God. And so if Israelite won, it meant their God was the one true God. If Goliath won, it meant their God was the one true God. So this wasn't just about who was the better man. It was who had the better God. And so David sees this as a problem. He's like, why are we scared? I don't care how big and bad that guy is. We're the army of the living God. He sees a problem, and you need to ask yourself, what is a problem that just bothers me that should not exist in my world? For some of you, it won't be hard to figure out because some of you have experienced something, and maybe it's something like cancer. Maybe you've survived cancer or a family member of yours has survived cancer, and you see a problem with it. You see a problem with the way that they're dealing with it. You see a problem with the healthcare system. You see a problem with raising funds. There's something about it that just says, that's not right. There's a problem with that. Or maybe you've suffered through just an unfortunate divorce. And even though you didn't want the divorce, even though you were trying to make everything right, you got a divorce. And instead of embracing you and helping you heal through this, the church turned its back on you. And maybe that's your problem. Maybe you say, you know what, I need to be the type of person that just opens my arms to people and helps people heal. I need to create a ministry. I need to start something to help point people back to the God of second chances. Or maybe you're like an amazing organization called PORT. This summer I met with this organization called PORT, and they opened my eyes to something I didn't even know existed. They told me that in Newport News there are zero men's and women's shelters for the homeless. Zero. They said that there is one that will take in men, only men, but it's for like an extended period of time, and you have to be willing to do like all the steps that they want you to do. But if you're like a homeless woman or a homeless child, a teenager, if you're a man and have already been through their program or don't want to go through it, and it's cold in Virginia, you have no place to go. And so Port said, that's a problem. That's wrong. And so instead of asking someone else to do something about it, they decided to start partnering with churches. And they go around and they find churches who can open their doors for a week and the homeless come in. And then they ask other churches just to host them. They asked churches to provide a meal for them and to hang out with them. And so in the month of March, Port is actually coming here to this building. And for one whole week, churches that meet here are going to just support and love the homeless. And one night during that week, Next Level Church, it's going to be our Make a Difference for the month. We're going to be there and we're just going to love the homeless. We're going to share a meal with them. We're going to feed them. We're going to hug them. We're going to give them a handshake. We're going to tell them about Jesus. We're going to do anything we can to make sure they have an amazing night so that they're not out on the streets. What is the problem, though, in your world? What is it? What is the problem that just doesn't sit right with you, that you serve the living God and you're like, because God is alive, this should not exist? If you're finding that you're just living the mundane life, if you're finding that you're bored, if you find that you don't have a great story, that's the first question you need to ask. But that leads to a second question, and the second question is, what is a need that is being ignored? What is a need that is being ignored? It's not enough just to establish a problem, because there's lots of problems. And there's some problems that actually aren't being ignored. People are doing things about it. But what is the creative take that you can put to this? What is the thing that you can say, hey, here's a huge problem, and no one's doing anything about it? It's being ignored. And if you look in David's story, he established the problem. There is a giant who is defying the armies of the living God. And if you know how the story ends, he comes up with an answer to this solution. What is it? What is the thing that's being ignored in your world? What is the need? What is the niche? How can you fit in? If you want to start living a great story, you've got to know you are God's character. But you've got to say, what has God wired me to do? What is the problem? And then what are the needs that are being ignored? You discover that and you'll find that you will be living an amazing story. Now, I told you I love great stories, but I think that you need to experience a great story. I was recently watched a story of two brothers that lived out exactly what we're talking about. And I think that this will do more than inspire you. Check this out.
That doctor pretty much told us, you know, your son is going to be a burden on your family. Put him in a home. You've already got one kid. He's okay. This one has cerebral palsy. Like, he's going to be a vegetable. He's going to be in a wheelchair the rest of his life. He'll never leave your house. Put him in a home.
When we found out we were having another little boy, they are so close in age. They were supposed to be biking and fishing together. But what Connor did for Caden and that one little choice to do a race on a weekend, it changed them.
It changed.
My name's Connor and my brother's name is Caden and we race together in triathlons.
For most young boys like Connor Long, the bonds of childhood are formed outdoors, playing together. But Connor's six-year-old brother, Caden, has been relegated to the sidelines for most of his life. Then, an idea born out of a desire to connect with Caden. To become not just brothers or even playmates, but teammates, competing together in triathlon.
When I see him smiling and laughing, that means he's having a good time.
And though they would finish last, they finished together. As one.
He's really excited before the race. He stays up to like 1 or 2 in the morning. But after that, he falls asleep in the cart.
Our kitchen usually have this type of breakfast on the weekend.
The one thing that makes me really mad is when people walk down the road and say the R word, if you know what that is. I just tell them that, like, it doesn't matter what he looks like on the outside, it's matter what's on the inside. And he still has regular feelings like we do. And he understands what you say about him. If people could race with people that can't walk or talk or have any kind of autism, it might open eyes of people that don't really care about it. And maybe the people that don't care in the past will care in the future and actually do it with somebody. 10 years from now, the perfect place for me and Caden would be, like, you know how people have the American flag on the moon? We'll have the Team Long Brothers flag on the moon.
Please join me in welcoming to the stage the winners of the 2012 Sports Illustrated Kids Sports Kid of the Year contest, joined by their parents, Connor and Caden Long.
Hello, everybody. This is really awesome for me and Caden to do this because we've been waiting for a very long time. And a lot of people think that we would never be able to do something like this, but we can always do anything.
I'm lost for words. Connor and Caden are the real sportsmen of the years. They label it as sports kids. Nah, they're the real sportsmen of the year. That story right there is, if it didn't go off soon, it would have had me in tears. You guys are definitely coming down to Miami to see a game, to meet our team. You guys are unbelievable. And what you do for your brother is unbelievable. I got two sons, 8 and 5. So they will be seeing that story. I don't have to preach anymore because what you do, I can just show that in my older son and know what he should do for his younger brother.
When I saw that video, it just screamed that it fits what we're talking about. Connor says of his brother that people may look at the outside, but it doesn't matter what's on the outside. It matters what's on the inside. And it's the same thing that God says of you. And Connor sees a problem. The problem is that he has a brother that people say the R word to. So he wants to spend time with him. And he comes up with a creative solution that nobody is doing. And that story inspires millions of people. And I kept the end of that clip up there because LeBron James, if you're not in the sports world, LeBron James was the Sports Illustrated Athlete of the Year. That's why he was there. And he was presented with his award after he saw these kids. And what did he talk about? He couldn't talk about himself. He was moved because of the story of two young kids. And I'm telling you tonight, you may never be featured on a magazine. They may never make a movie of you. But you have the army of the living God living inside of you. And you were wired to live an amazing story. So I just want to ask you, what is the story that you're leaving for your spouse? What is the story that you're leaving for your kids? If you're single, what is the story that you're leaving for your future spouse and your future kids? If you're here today, what's the story that you're leaving for your friends, for your community? You should live such an amazing story that people point to you and they give God the glory. Will you pray with me? God, tonight we just come before you and we just thank you that you're patient with us. Even though so oftentimes we get stuck in the mundane, God, you still have just wired us and pushed us and draw us to you. And so, God, we just ask that now you would just inspire us to do more. Not because we have to, but because you've done so much in our lives. God, we thank you that you love us, and we ask that you would give us a problem, that you would give us something that would drive us to become passionate about you, that you'd help us to focus on our hearts and not just what's on the outside. And God, we ask that you'd help us to come up with creative solutions, things that no one's thinking of, so that we could point people back to your glory. We thank you and praise you so much for what you're going to do in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.